4 times a day, Linda Fisher applies moisturizing lotion to the scars that run from her shoulders to her fingers. She suffered second and third degree burns over 30% of her body in the Station nightclub fire.
I have a hard time with sensing if I'm hot or cold. I can get overheated very quickly and not realize it and be very sick. Or if I'm not paying attention, I can get cold, like, to the core, where it, like, I'm shaking because I didn't realize how cold I was because I don't feel the sensation on my arms.
Fisher was one of 462 people who crowded into West Warwick's Station nightclub on February 20th, 2003, to hear the heavy metal rock group Great White. The band had just started its opening song, Desert Moon, when tour manager Dan Beakley set off pyrotechnics on stage. The sparks set fire to highly flammable soundproofing foam that covered the club's ceiling and walls. Paul Bertolo, a Brockton, Massachusetts auto mechanic, remembers the sounds of the dying as he escaped through a window.
It was havoc. The smoke was really intense. A lot of people were screaming. A lot of people were saying, I don't want to die this way.
Some patrons initially thought the fire was part of the act, but as the truth dawned, they made a mad dash for the exits. There were 4 doors, but most people headed towards the front door through which they had entered. The stampede caused a pile of bodies to form from floor to ceiling. Gina Russo, the mother of 2 young sons, found herself in that pile until someone pulled her out.
I burned over 40% of my body. The burns on my arms, my back are third-degree burns, and my head was burned fourth degree, so my head burned right to the skull. I'll never have my own hair. I have to wear a wig for the rest of my life. And then my lungs were actually worse than my burns. 3 days after the fire, I was read my last rites because my lungs were shutting down and all my internal organs were shutting down. I'm very blessed to be alive.
News of the fire shot around the world because it had been videotaped. Station nightclub co-owner Jeffrey Derderian was also a reporter at WPRI Channel 12. That night, he had a videographer in the club taping pictures for a story on nightclub safety. Dave Kane, whose 18-year-old son Nicholas O'Neill would be the youngest person to die in the fire, rushed to West Warwick when he saw it on the news. Unable to get close to the scene, he went to Rhode Island Hospital, where many of the victims had been taken.
I actually heard somebody in the waiting room at Rhode Island Hospital, this guy saying how many people had died, and I thought this guy was just trying to be important. He was saying that all kinds of people had died and that the whole building was blown down, and he described what actually had been the case, but at the time, we didn't know it. And I just thought this guy was exaggerating.
In the ensuing weeks and months, Rhode Islanders learned there was plenty of blame to go around. The owners of the club, brothers Jeffrey and Michael Derderian, had routinely allowed the use of pyrotechnics without a permit or licensed operator, as required by law. The capacity of the club was 404, but on the night of the fire, nearly 500 people packed in. And West Warwick Fire Marshal Dennis LaRocque told a grand jury he didn't notice the flammable foam covering the walls and ceiling. Rhode Island law required then, and still does, fire-resistant decorations to be used in places of public accommodation. Fire survivor Paul Bertolo says LaRocque should have been prosecuted.
I've always blamed the fire inspector, basically, for not doing their job. If they know that there was stuff in the wall that shouldn't have been there. That's what they do. A lot of people do stupid things and try to save money, but that's why you pay inspectors to do their job.
Burn victim Gina Russo shares the same feeling about LaRocque.
If you saw this foam, and I don't know how anyone didn't see it, it was there. It was painted black on the walls. How do you pretend you don't see that? It's amazing to me that these professional people who would have all hold some sort of degree in this all look the other way.
LaRocque has since retired on a disability claim and isn't commenting on the 10th anniversary. Attorney John Baralek, who represented many of the victims and went on to write the definitive account of the tragedy in the book Killer Show, says the tragedy was the result of a lot of people not doing their jobs.
Incidents like this, one person doing the right thing can usually avoid the tragedy, whether it be an inspector or someone complying with a fireworks ordinance, something like that. In this case, it was, as some have said, a perfect storm. Many small mistakes were made, and they were usually mistakes of omission usually motivated by profit motive or laziness.
Only two people would go to jail, and not for very long. Band manager Dan Beakley, who set off the fireworks, served 2 years of a 4-year sentence. And club co-owner Michael Derderian served 2 years and 3 months of a 4-year sentence before being paroled for good behavior. Brother Jeffrey Derderian got off with only community service. And neither brother has ever paid a cent of his own money to settle the many claims that emanated from the fire, though they may still be held liable for a $1 million fine for not carrying workers' compensation insurance. Survivors and victims' families ultimately shared in a $176 million settlement from defendants as diverse as Channel 12 and Anheuser-Busch. The fire has also changed survivors' lives. Russo, who lost her fiancé in the blaze but has since married, says she likes her post-fire life better than her pre-fire existence.
I love my life. I'm strong. I'm confident. It hasn't stopped me, that's for sure. It's made me stronger. It's made me want to fight for people who have disabilities.
And through therapy, Linda Fisher has come to accept the burn scars that require frequent moisturizing.
Anytime you're disfigured, it's a choice. You need to decide how you're going to see yourself, because how you see yourself, it does translate through your actions and your how you approach people, how you speak, how you carry yourself, how you dress. I made a choice that I'm going to accept this because, for one, I'm lucky I even have scarred hands and arms. I have friends that are missing those particular parts of their body, and my heart breaks for them.
The site of the fire today is a ragtag collection of weather-worn crosses, balloons, flowers, teddy bears, and burned-out candles. But that's about to change. Last fall, the owner of the land deeded the property over to the Station Fire Memorial Foundation for a permanent park.
One, two, three.
And last Sunday, survivors broke ground on the project.
Yes.
Rhode Island's fire code was strengthened as a result of the fire. Sprinklers became mandatory for all nightclubs that hold more than 150 people. And crowd crisis training is now required of employees in most large commercial establishments. But if there's anything the station fire taught us, it's that laws are only as good as the people enforcing them. Flo Jonick, Rhode Island Public Radio.
Flo Jonick was at the station nightclub right after the fire covering the story, and she joins us in the studio now for some personal reflection. Flo, where were you when you first heard about the fire?
Well, Elizabeth, I was working for a Boston radio station. They called me at home to tell me that as many as a dozen people may have died at a nightclub in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and to get down there as fast as I could. It was 2 a.m. I promised to hit the road right away, but I remember telling the assignment editor that it seemed unlikely that so many people had died.
And what did the scene look like when you first arrived?
Well, as I got closer to the scene, I found myself part of a convoy of ambulances, mostly from Massachusetts, so I just followed them. I arrived about 4 a.m. It was wild at that scene. Cohasset Avenue was jammed with rescue trucks, ambulances, and media vehicles. And then the press conferences started. I don't remember who held them, but they were held hourly, and the death toll just kept going up throughout that morning. When I was relieved of duty that afternoon, it stood at about 75.
And how big of a media scene was it?
Well, since word of the fire had shot around the world so quickly because the fire was videotaped, the media converged very quickly. In his book, Killer Show, author and attorney John Berlick says there were 100 media representatives on scene by late morning. I don't know where he got that number, but I can believe it. I can tell you that it was so crowded I had to drive a half mile away from the scene every time I did a report just to get a cell phone signal. I realize now, of course, that some of that cell phone activity was frantic relatives trying to reach people who would never answer.
Wow. And Flo, was this your first exposure to then Rhode Island Governor Don Carcieri?
It was. Carcieri had been inaugurated to his first term in office only 6 weeks before this happened. He was an unknown entity outside the state. I do remember out-of-town press commenting positively on how in control and calming and compassionate he seemed.
Now, I understand that you knew nightclub owner Jeffrey Derderian before the fire?
Yes. Coincidentally, he and I had worked as freelance writers together at a Boston TV station some years earlier. I remember passing him on the street that morning and being glad I wasn't him.
Well, Flo, it has been a decade since that night. What's the one scene that sticks with you all these years later?
Well, Elizabeth, as I came to know the circumstances surrounding the fire, I can't help but wonder if it could have been prevented, if somebody had just done their job, if the outcome might have been different.
I'm sure that question remains in the minds of many people, particularly the survivors of the victims. Flo Jahnik, Rhode Island Public Radio reporter, thank you so much for sharing your memories of this really tragic night.
Thank you, Elizabeth.